The mountains protected this short stretch of coastline from the harsh north winds that swept down from Russia. There was no snow. Winter had given way to spring. Everyone's spirits rose. Around 6 p.m., as dusk was falling, FDR's limousine pulled into a driveway lined with pine, palm, and cypress trees. Banks of roses and oleander parted to reveal a large Renaissance-style villa set on a bluff 200 feet above the sea. He had reached the Livadia Palace, the favourite vacation spot of Tsar Nicholas II. "I can't understand Winston's concern," muttered Roosevelt as he was wheeled around the ground floor of the 116-room palace in his wheelchair. "This place has all the comforts of home." The Russians had done their best to make the president comfortable. Big log fires were burning cheerfully in most of the downstairs rooms. A maître d'hôtel greeted FDR with many bows from the waist, addressing him as "Your Excellency." The palace had been stripped bare by the Germans and subsequently renovated in a frantic, month-long operation that involved the shipment of hundreds of railway wagons of supplies to the Crimea from Moscow. Thousands of NKVD secret police and Red Army soldiers were mobilized to paint walls and repair the plumbing, while Romanian prisoners of war restored the grounds to a semblance of their Tsarist splendor. The furniture and principal furnishings, including plates, china and bed linen, came from Moscow's leading hotels, along with the maids, waiters and cooks. The Russians were still scouring Yalta and other nearby towns for accessories such as shaving mirrors, coat hangers and washbowls. Roosevelt was shown the large ballroom with white marble columns, next to the entrance hall, with a round table already prepared for the conference with Stalin and Churchill. A private suite of rooms had been prepared for him in the adjoining wing of the palace, also leading off the entrance hall, next to a Moorish garden. The bedroom and dining room were furnished in what a member of the American advance team described as early Pullman car style. Heavy, outsized paintings hung on mahogany-panelled walls. Brass lamps with orange silk shades and long fringe were scattered around on tables, and Bukhara rugs and bottle-green plush harem cushions were scattered on the floors. Here and there, a handsome Russian Empire piece glowed in contrast to the stolid chests, sofas, tables and chairs that Moscow had scraped together for the occasion. The hosts had spent much of the last few days moving rugs and paintings in and out of the president's bedroom, unable to decide which oriental colours looked best. They had set and reset the dining room table, experimenting with various place settings. FDR was much more concerned about his evening martini routine, a hallowed tradition at the White House. After a long day, he loved to relax with friends at Children's Hour, mixing the gin, vermouth and olive brine in a silver cocktail shaker with large helpings of ice. When Anna sent for the necessary ingredients, she was dismayed to learn there was no ice. Instead of martinis, the maître d' proposed some sweet concoction that appeared to be a mixture of just about everything. The presidential party quickly gave up on the cocktails and sat down to dinner in the Tsar's billiard room. "Immediately, our tiny glasses were filled with vodka," Anna recorded in her diary that night. "We were served delicious caviar, then some sliced fish, which is uncooked but cured in some way, and which even my hardy tummy found a bit hard to take. This was followed by a game course, then some meat on a skewer with potatoes, and finally two kinds of dessert and coffee, and white wine, red wine, champagne with dessert, and liqueur with coffee. Every time anything was refused, the maître d'hôtel looked either like a thundercloud or mortally wounded." FDR retired to bed after dinner.